dude. Mary, Stone, and John talked about the gradual training. And then we had Mary Hoberman with sensual desire. Jean went through ill will. Mary and Geneva, sloth and torpor. Then last week, Mary and Geneva with restlessness and remorse. And that brings us to tonight, the fifth hindrance, doubt, uncertainty. So we'll be talking about that tonight. Doubt's been called the most dangerous of the five hindrances. I've also heard it called the mother of the five hindrances. So it's a really big one, and it's an important one to pay attention to. As Anjan Jeff says, to note mindfully and immediately the arising of one of the hindrances is a simple but very effective method of countering these and any other defilements of the mind. By doing so, a break is applied against uninhibited continuance of unwholesome thoughts, and the watchfulness of mind against their recurrence is strengthened. So we're really learning to notice the hindrances, and that's a really important step. So what is doubt? Well, I've discovered through this investigation that doubt has many faces, and it takes on some different forms, so we'll be discussing those tonight. Basically, when doubt shows up, it's like standing at a crossroads and not being able to choose which way to go. So here's a good quote that Steve found that is really pretty much sums it up. It's from Robert Bagoda from A Simple Guide to Life. Doubt is the inability to decide, the lack of resolution that prevents one from making a firm commitment to higher ideals and from pursuing the good with a steady will. So when doubt is present, we spend so much time and energy in indecision that we get exhausted and can't carry on, and it brings our practice to a standstill. So the Buddha says, if there is a pot of water which is turbid, stirred up, and muddy, and this pot is put into a dark place, then a person with normal eyesight would not recognize and see his or her own image reflected in the water. In the same way, when one's mind is possessed by doubt, overpowered by doubt, then one cannot properly see the escape from doubt which has arisen. Then one does not properly understand one's own welfare, nor that of another, nor that of both. So I've been imagining this pot of water, turbid and muddy. So I wish I had some dirt to put in there. And then we're going to put it in a dark place. Sort of. So, let's see here. So, it seems to me that if your pot is stirred up and in a dark place, it would be difficult to see even when any of the hindrances were present. How would you notice if the colors of sense desire are present, if the pot is boiling with ill will, cooled down and filled with the algae of sloth and torpor, blown by the winds of restlessness, if they sit in the dark? If we're able to understand and see the stirred up mud of doubt enough to spill it, well, two. So if we're able to understand and see the stirred up mud of doubt enough to let it settle to the bottom, then and only then can we skillfully plant the seeds of enlightenment. So tonight we're going to take doubt out of the dark place and start looking at it. Because if we know what to look for, we can stop getting caught up in the hindrances and see, this is for you, BJ, that as David Foster Wallace says in his famous commencement speech, this is water. So there are a few different ways doubt shows up, and Steve is going to start with some of those.
Yeah. Well, so that doubt isn't all a bad thing. I think doubt probably got most of us to look into Buddhism in the first place. We were uncertain with the spiritual teachings that we might have grown up with. We were questioning, seeing if there's a better way. And then when we arrive in Buddhism, we find that it's got this strength, which is that it's a real strength for most of us because it gives us permission to ask questions and to think for ourselves. And that's that's a radical departure from the spiritual tradition I grew up in. And in fact, it doesn't just give us permission, it demands that we ask questions and question things. I'm going to read the section from the Kalama Sutta. Here it is. So this is the Buddha talking to people in Kalama. Of course you are uncertain, Kalamas. Of course you are in doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, Kalamas, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability, or by thought, or by the thought. This contemplative is our teacher. When you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you should abandon them. By the same token, when you know for yourselves that these qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness, then you should enter and remain in them. So there's, you know, definite encouragement to question, and there's another one, shorter one. Thich Nhat Hanh says, "Do not be idolatrous about or bound to any doctrine, theory, or ideology, even Buddhist ones. Buddhist systems of thought are guiding means; they are not absolute truth." And I'm going to throw in just the dictionary definition of the scientific method while I'm at it. It's a method consisting in systematic observation, measurement, and experiment, and the formulation, testing, and modification of hypotheses, which I think very much lines up with the spirit of Buddhism. And I think it's a reason that a lot of us that we found Buddhism attractive in the first place. So on first glance, it might seem odd to see doubt, which has so many positive qualities, as one of the big five here. Aren't we supposed to be skeptical and full of doubt, according to what we just read? And so we come to the question of, when is doubt a hindrance? And I'm afraid the answer is kind of a tautology. Doubt becomes a hindrance when it hinders. There's this thin and unclear line, as far as I can see it, between healthy doubt and unwholesome doubt. And so we're going to be looking at how to figure out where that line is. And it's not a fixed place all the time. Sometimes it moves around. We'll be looking at two aspects of doubt and uncertainty: doubt about the path or the practice, and then doubt about our own personal capabilities, two aspects of it. So I'm going to start with a little bit on the practice and then let Iris talk about some of the self-doubt issues. So the question is when and how doubt crosses this line from being healthy questioning to a hindrance in our practice. And I bet we could all sit here and think about things within the teaching that we have doubts about, things that we're just not sure are there yet. Maybe it's the idea of rebirth, or whether we'll each really reap the karma of all our actions, or whether some of the clairvoyance and some of the special powers that are talked about in higher jhanas, whether those are real or what those are about. Or whether a decision to go on a retreat is the right one or not. Is it worthwhile going on a retreat? Do you really get anything out of it? Or whether there's really anything... enlightenment. if there really is anything like enlightenment.
Was that on purpose?
No, just bad writing. So, maybe just pause for a minute and see if where do you have questions like that about the practice, about Buddhism? And if you do, how do they get in the way of your growth? How do they seem to be a hindrance? For me, I find that when I let my doubts, my uncertainties run wild, that it's kind of like an anesthetic, kind of a paralyzing action. It kind of stops me from applying the kind of energy and resolve that it takes to make progress. It can really be a sapping of strength. And then there are also a lot of comfortable and habitual ways of doing things that those can kind of make you uncertain and kind of hold you back from fully engaging in the practice. That's how I saw in the email I sent out, I saw the doubt as this kind of smoldering mass that keeps the other hindrances burning. Like I'm comfortable with, you know, I've got a certain amount of comfort in my, you know, the food I eat, the tastes I have, and I like food this way and not another way. And I think a lot of those kind of get in the way of, it makes me a little less ardent about seeing food as just nutriment for the body. You know, I want it to taste good as well. Most of us do. And then what's so bad about unwinding, sitting in a stupor in front of the football game on TV? Well, you've kind of got a little bit of doubt, not enough doubt to really follow through on your resolve to stay mindful. And as a result, you're kind of falling into this sloth and torpor state. So you're kind of going into another hindrance because of your doubt, or at least being fed, that other hindrance is being fed by the doubt. And then, you know, even if you're sitting in meditation and you start thinking, yeah, I just don't have it this time. It's really not working. I should just get up and find something better to do. You know, you've got this uncertainty that's feeding the restlessness there. So those are just a few little ways. You could probably think of a lot of examples of your own of how that smoldering doubt kind of spreads and kind of holds you back, kind of stops you getting as far as you could in the practice. So I found this interesting article. I'll post it on the website. Somebody named Bodhipaksa. He's a Scottish Buddhist monk. And he's got this quote here. Doubt as a hindrance involves, on an emotional level, a collapse in trust. We lack confidence in ourselves, or we lack confidence in the practice we're doing, or we lack confidence in others and in whether they have anything to offer us. At its mildest, doubt can simply be a form of disgruntlement, disengagement, or confusion. But at its most severe, it can become a crushing burden of depression. So doubting as a hindrance means I'm not really taking in life fully. I'm not taking in the practice or life fully. And I'm not participating because I'm holding back because of this uncertainty. So I'll let Iris say a bit about personal doubt, and then we'll go on to tools for working with doubt.
So personal doubt is something I'm very familiar with, and I started to get curious about it when Ajahn Santi said, people who are filled with doubt are often overwhelmed with life. Interesting. I think I have more confidence in the teachings and the practice than my ability to follow them. So when we're working with other hindrances and we heard from John and Mary about cultivating contentment, and I was working with these and I thought, oh, okay, I get this. And then a little self-doubt came in. I thought, it's Thursday night. I want to feel contentment. I wonder if I should go get some ice cream or if I should go to the Dharma Hall. And I drive around Bowen Mallards. I don't know. Drive over to the Dharma Hall. And with self-doubt, it's really, which one is the best? I mean, it's so hard to choose. So here I am at the Dharma Hall. And so it's a tough one, that self-doubt, because it's really that lacking of confidence in yourself. And, you know, right before the Buddha gained his enlightenment, Mara, who's the demon who's tempting him as he's sitting under the Bodhi tree, he's unleashing all of these temptations. And the final challenge is, who shall speak for you? Which he's basically saying, who are you? I've got my whole army and all these people behind me to stand behind me. And you're a guy under a tree. Who are you? And the Buddha, kind of in this ultimate act of trust in himself and in the way things are, puts his hand down to the earth. And Mara flees. And later that night, he gains his enlightenment. So self-doubt is tricky like that. Self-doubt is tricky like Mara. And if you start to pay attention to the voices of self-doubt, they really catch you, because if you notice, they start masquerading as wisdom. Hey, ice cream's good. You know, you've had a long day. You've been busy. Go for it. Or, you know, it's really the skillful choice is really the Dharma. And okay, so paying attention to those and which ones are skillful and which ones are unskillful. And where is the temptress of doubt talking? Can be really tricky. In fact, when self-doubt is strongly conditioned, and I think in our culture it really can be, because it's about self-worth, it's about, am I good enough to do this? Am I worthy to gain this? And if it's really conditioned in us, Philip Moffitt says, it's not only a spiritual hindrance, but an existential crisis. So doubt can really catch us. You know, how can you decide which road to take if you don't trust yourself? So, Karen, you wanted a joke. You may have heard this before, because it's really about self-worth here. If you can start the day without caffeine or pep pills, if you can be cheerful, ignoring aches and pains, if you can resist complaining and boring people with your troubles, if you can understand when loved ones are too busy to give you time, if you can overlook when people take things out on you when, through no fault of yours, something goes wrong. If you can take criticism and blame without resentment. If you can face the world without lies and deceit. If you can conquer tension without medical help. If you can relax without liquor. If you can sleep without the aid of drugs. Then you are probably a dog. So part of working with doubt is about accepting the difficulties of life as a condition of life. And so, you know, sometimes you need to watch your football game or relax with a little liquor. But as you start to accept that this is life and that doubt arises, your tolerance for uncertainty grows. You become calmer when it arises. And you can say, I'm here, and I'm worthy of the teachings. So that's a little bit about self-doubt. Threw in a joke for you. So we're going to now kind of dive into well, here's doubt now. What are some really, how do we work with it? What do we do when it's there and it's hard to see?
Yeah, so we're going to look at some of the teachings on how to work with doubt. I'm going to start with a quote by, well, let's see. I guess it's time to hand out so you could pass those around. So don't turn them over yet. Only read the first side. Should say doubt on the top.
It does.
So we're going to use this this list, which comes from Bhikkhu Bodhi, and it's out of a table that he's got for each of the hindrances, how to work with them. And we'll be looking at some of these remedies and antidotes that he talks about here. But I want to start with a quote by Ajahn Brahm about doubt, which really gets to, in your list of remedies there, the last one, noble friends and noble conversations. Ajahn Brahm says, doubt in one's ability is overcome by nurturing self-confidence with a good teacher, but I would include with a good sangha, spiritual friends, so I think that's where this comes in. A meditation teacher or spiritual friends are like a coach who convinces the sports team that they can succeed. The Lord Buddha stated that one can, one will reach jhana and enlightenment if one carefully and patiently follows the instructions. The only uncertainty is when. Experience also overcomes doubt about one's ability, and also doubt about whether this is the right path. As one realizes for oneself the beautiful stages of the path, one discovers that one is indeed capable of the very highest, and that this is the path that leads one there. So as I said, this is a classic list of where doubt comes from. The primary condition for doubt is careless, unwise attention to things that are the basis for doubt. So, and the So the antidote there, careful attention to contrasting mental qualities, is explained. That's at the bottom of the page is actually an expansion of that. So these are the qualities that need to be looked at, and it. So there are things which are wholesome or unwholesome, blameless or blameworthy, noble or low, and other contrasts of dark and bright. Frequently giving wise attention to them, that is the denourishing of the arising of doubt that has not yet arisen, and of the denourishing of the increase in strengthening of doubt that has already arisen. So, how does it help? Does anybody have any thoughts on how paying attention to wholesome versus unwholesome mental states, how that can help unwind doubt?
You got listed here asking questions that caught my eye, because that's what I would do to relieve doubt, would be to inquire.
Yeah, I think it's...
So asking questions.
I think it's, as you study things, as you do the first remedy of learning, you're looking at the distinction between unwholesome and wholesome. And as those become more clear to you, you no longer have, you no longer need to be uncertain whether this is good or bad. And so you, it's a matter of studying and learning and questioning to get clear on what's wholesome and unwholesome. And that I think is the meaning here of the careful attention to these contrasts.
I was really struck by something Iris said, which is really, I think you said, sort of recognizing that the conditions that are the conditions that are. It's not that something's wrong or you're wrong or it's like the three characteristics. It's like there's suffering, there's impermanence, there's no permanent sense of self, and the experience of that is often unpleasant. And so we say, well, something must be wrong. Either the practice is wrong or I'm wrong or something's wrong. But I think what you said is really seeing clearly this just is creates, I mean, I wouldn't say contentment, but maybe equanimity or a little bit of calmness. And I think you have very good examples of that and very good stories about that. So I think that's really helpful to sort of see the universality of these things that we say, could this, there must be something wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things that got me to include the scientific method in the list is looking at these remedies. It's really a matter of doing that kind of questioning and kind of scientifically pulling apart what's good and what's wholesome, what's unwholesome. Kind of really doing that, the questioning and the study that's going to get you to some clarity that gets you past those kind of doubts. And
so in part, if it's like your scientific method sort of says this would be a skillful way, when doubt arises, even though it doesn't feel like that's what you want to do, you sort of are saying,
yeah,
I have faith that this is the way through this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've kind of looked at it and you can see what's wholesome and what's not, even if you're conditioned to go the other way.
I love the Sharon Salzberg quote about bright faith, mm-hmm, of, oh, this feels good, I like this, and then, oh, now there's this part that doesn't feel good, and then you keep going and you do these things, you ask questions, you work with skills in the precepts, you talk to your Dharma friends, and you start to have this verified faith, mm-hmm, of, oh yeah, okay, so you feel it in your body, mm-hmm, a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You grow that confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the skills in the precepts, you working with the precepts, doing a little bit of renunciation, kind of simplifies things and gives you some clarity and moral strength that kind of helps with certainty and getting past doubt. So I think that's how that gets in the list here. Resolve is another interesting one. Not holding back, making a commitment to follow through on a practice, kind of gets you through those rough spots where it takes a little bit of trust and faith to get by. Do you have any other?
Yeah. One of the other things about doubt is that I find when I'm having kind of a doubt attack, is I really want to know in those moments. Like, I'm really trying to figure out things. And so I've got these voices going on that it's like one saying, no, I want this. And no, it's like that road. I'm going to go this way and I want to know why. And I want I go this way, and I want to know why, and I'm balancing it. And what I'm finding is that working with doubt really happens when we close around uncertainty instead of opening to it. Mm-hmm. So when we're getting closed around this uncertain nature of things and wanting to know, well, things are uncertain. That's the Dharma. That's the law of the universe. Mm-hmm. And cultivating don't know mind, so when you're in this place of doubt, maybe stepping back a little and saying, I don't know, and it's okay. Because doubt is cloudy. And so stepping back a little bit and recognize, wait, it's the mud in the water. Okay, I'm going to let it settle so I can see clearly. That's been really helpful. It helped me a lot because I tell you, writing a talk about self-doubt and doubt is a difficult endeavor. So I called on that last night when I was going through it. I don't know how it's going to go, and that's okay. So that was really helping, really helped me. Another thing that has helped me in my process with doubt is working with refuge. In that book on faith, Sharon Salzberg talks about, I mean, she's 18 and in India learning this, and all these habits, like you said, all these habits are coming up and trying to change these. And she says in this sweet passage in that book that she really needed to find a place of safety so that she could change these things. Because if you're just going like this, well, why should I change this? I don't know. There's no real, you know, solid ground to stand on. So one of the things about taking refuge, and I was just reading some Thich Nhat Hanh about refuge. Take refuge in the Buddha. It doesn't have to be this, it's this guy, it's these teachings, but really taking refuge in your Buddha nature right here. So taking refuge is about pausing and breathing and recognizing that the only ground that's solid is right here, right now. And that's also taking refuge in the Dharma, finding that place and that self-trust in yourself. So the opposite of doubt is trust. And so that refuge in finding that safe place. The Buddha also described, another simile he used to describe doubt, is being a rich man and you're on a lone desert road in the middle. So if you're doubtful in that, it's scary. So finding a safe place, when you find that place of safety after you've been across this, that's what the end of doubt feels like. So refuge is where we find that safe place. And another thing that kind of goes along that is just is developing trust, that verified faith. Ajahn Chah says, when I had been practicing for only 2 or 3 years, I still could not trust myself. But after I had experienced much, I learned to trust my own heart. You will reach a point where the heart tells itself what to do. It is constantly prodding, constantly mindful. And you can't do that without that resolve of jumping in and going there. But I tell you, I'm still really working on this, especially the self-doubt piece. And I was like, well, okay, I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that confidence, but what kind of practice do I need? And I just love this quote again, Ajahn Chah, he just sums it up so nicely. Relying on yourself to do little things, like cleaning up carefully after the meal, doing chores gracefully and mindfully, not banging on kettles, helps develop concentration and makes practice easier. So just trusting yourself to clean up after your meal. That it develops that practice and that concentration. So to finish, I wanted to just give you a little personal story of doubt here. I had been kind of engaging with the Dharma for about 1.5 years. This was 2 years ago. Right? So I had some experience. I knew some Pali words and heard a few Dharma talks. And I experienced, it was 2 years ago, actually this month, and I was in an elementary school principal's office with a physical therapist and a school nurse, and they suggested to me that my son had a muscular disease. And this was, he was diagnosed a few months later. But when they told me that, I experienced 30 seconds of clear seeing. I remember all the details of that room. And those 30 seconds caused me to doubt all the conditioning that came before, because I had seen past it. I had seen through the mud. And so it did that for me. It gave me that inquiring doubt that we're talking about. It caught my hair on fire. It was like, okay, all right, I'm seeing this. This is working. This is just, I'm reading the Dharma. It's describing what's happening to me. I'm like, whew. Well, a lot happened. I learned a lot. I did a talk. I started reading tons. And then just about the time I signed up to do a talk about doubt, I hit a hard spot. What am I doing? Is this real? Was that real? That was only 30 seconds. I mean, really. What could that have taught me? I don't. I'm crazy. You know, I'm living in this culture that doesn't support this very much. You know, I should buy more. Maybe I should just go buy a new car, buy a new house, buy some new clothes. My choices are changing about the work I'm doing, the people I'm hanging out with. I don't know. This is crazy. I think this is insane. What am I doing? Well, I think Jean noticed this. This is where our noble friends come in. And then I sent her an email that was like, oh, this is what I'm doing. I don't know. And Jean says, well, it's interesting that you're doing a talk about doubt. I think this is doubt. Oh, this is doubt. So it led me to recognize, just by seeing the doubt, that that's also not me. And I think with all the hindrances, as we begin to recognize that we are the water, and the hindrances are these things that come through us, ill will, whatever it is, sensory desire, I want some apple pie, any of that. And we get where we get caught is where we identify with it. We think it's us. And so that helped me a lot through doubt. And now I have this skill that when I see it coming and I feel it in my body and I'm starting to learn, well, what's those voices? What do I feel? Then it's just doubt and it's going to pass. And I have some faith that it's going to do it because it's done it before. So that's how we do it. We have a little work for you now. You can
is it on the other side?
Flip it over.
So we need to get in our threesomes again. So if you could just kind of grab the three people near you, and we're going to. So there are two little reflection questions at the top that we're going to deal with tonight, and then the bottom of the page is homework if you want to practice with this for the next week. So we're going to, each of you will have 3 minutes to kind of consider one of these two questions and talk about it with your group. So the first one, consider carefully what doubts you have in relation to meditation practice and or Buddhist practice. Are you skeptical or uncertain about any of the teachings? So you can kind of talk about your uncertainty about teachings with each other. Second question, do you doubt your own ability to practice? Are you ambivalent about some of the goals or results of the practice? Does this uncertainty affect how you practice? In what ways might doubt interfere? So a lot of the things we've been discussing. So we'll just you pick somebody to start, and we'll guess we need a timepiece. And we'll go for about 3 minutes per person. So, ahead and start.